Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Mobility Radio, featuring industry leaders and innovators in mobile technology.
Good morning. This is Brett Cooper from Blue Fletch Mobile, and I got an exciting show this morning with Humanu Zafar from Kennesaw State and Greg Birch from Ingenico. So I think I'm going to start out with Humanu. And you, so your role is you're an assistant professor in the information security group, information security department. Actually, clarify what's the
Right. I'm an assistant professor of information security and assurance in the Department of Information Systems at Kennesaw State. Leave it to us to come up with.
Have you guys
titles.
Considered shortening that?
No.
No.
No. We just merged with other universities, and we're on our way at that point.
Nice. And so your background, you're a hacker by trade, and they decided to make you a professor. Is that what happened?
The sad part is they made me a professor. I'm not sure we like to use the H word. You know, hacker, we might just call it ethical hacking. Even that's a far stretch. But no, my undergrad's in computer science, PhD, with a concentration in InfoSec from the University of Texas, San Antonio. I got a master's in IT from Rochester.
Awesome. So you traveled the world and seen a lot and know how to ethically hack into systems.
Nice. I can either
right.
confirm
Silence.
Or deny.
Silence. Yeah. I like it. All right. So Kennesaw State. I know I've had a lot of talks with Rodwan and yourself in the past in regards to Metro Atlanta Chamber of Commerce, and you guys are doing a lot for mobility and mobility curriculum. Can you talk a little bit about KSU and what you guys are providing students from a standpoint of education in mobility?
Well, it's a fairly new concept for us. I'm sure you guys are aware of bureaucracies, right? You just can't up and decide.
I've heard about those.
Yeah, they exist. You just can't up and revamp your curriculum. It goes through a particular process, has to be approved by various stakeholders. We have multiple professors. So Radwan and I may be two professors, but when it comes to actually providing direction in this, you know, the entire department needs to be on board as well, because individually they teach different kinds of classes, be it analysis and design. And with mobility, the problem is, you know, the dynamics change. So from an information security point of view, we teach a class in firewalls and VPN. So, but in the mobile environment, and when it comes to mobility, really, there is no such thing as a firewall. So that really has to go away. Well, does that mean we just stop teaching that course? Because I'm sure there's plenty of folks who would like for our students to still be familiar with firewalls, for that matter. It's a somewhat useful thing. So our curriculum, you know, slowly but surely is at least accepting the fact that mobility is here to stay. Because for the longest time, we've really always been technology agnostic, if that's the term, I think.
Is that something that every like year you guys go through and add like three classes and take away one or two? What does that change process look like?
Well, I mean, so a course, and let's say I'll pick one, application development. If that was Java-based, all of a sudden the same course with the course description and the name, that's, again, fairly generic, means in the future if you want to switch it up to some other kind of a technology, some other kind of a dynamic, well, we can do that. So, yeah, that course all of a sudden will suddenly become Android development.
Awesome. And then the for students themselves, you know, when you guys look at somebody who graduates from the university, how prepared are they for a job in mobility? So if I go to KSU and specialize a computer information right. technology department and specialize in mobility, what are the skills I come out of school with and go into my career with?
All right. So it's interesting you mentioned computer information technology department. Those, I believe, are three different departments you just named as one.
You mentioned the bureaucracy. I just tried to string them all together.
That could be a bad idea. Information technology is its own department, because now that would merge with Southern Polytechnic, they've got a College of Computing. Information systems is actually housed in the College of Business. We have a center called the Mobile Application Development Center that I'm affiliated with. And that, the entire purpose of that center, it was set up a couple of years ago. The purpose was for students to actually train on various mobile technologies by working on real projects. So the center itself takes external as well as internal projects. Now, as far as which platform it covers, we do Android, Windows, as well as that other one.
So I think I've heard about this. In that center, you know, if an organization or a company has a project that they would be interested in working with you guys and getting some students from a capstone standpoint, how do they contact and reach out to you guys? Do they say, I have this concept, I want to partner,
right.
can KSU help me with resources?
Sure, they can actually email me or tweet, for that matter. They can also contact Dr. Solomon Nagash, who is the executive director of the Mobile Application Development Center. We have a webpage.
And can you talk about any of the successes of the companies that have engaged with you guys in regards to that?
Well, so we're only 2 years old. I believe we have 4 or 5 completed projects so far. I'm not sure if I can discuss the names of the firms, so I really have to go through that first.
Awesome. But the students themselves, so that those firms, you know, they engage with you guys, you and Dr. Solomon, and they go through, and you guys have, I'm assuming, like, you know, 1 to N students that are actually working on the projects.
Not just that, they are also, again, when you talk about real projects, and this is not an academic project or an academic exercise where not completing is okay. You know, yeah, learning curve is one thing, but we still have to finish the job. So these students do actually integrate with a professional developer, and again, it's more of an apprenticeship at that point as well. So they work with the developer. The developer gives them a certain series of tasks. Faculty will give them a series of tasks. And we're just hoping that by being introduced to a business project, they understand the importance of business communication, requirement analysis, and hopefully take it from there. Some of these things we simply can't teach in a classroom. We just can't simulate a great business process. Yeah, you've got a textbook, but to see it come to life is a completely different story.
Yeah, on the job is definitely a lot more high pressure than the tests and mm-hmm. other initiatives. So another question I had for you. So I guess with the students themselves, are there things that you perceive or that you're your team has looked at and see lacking in the next 4 to 5 years for students and things that you're trying to fill the gaps on?
I think sometimes they are overly dependent on what we teach them in the classroom. You need to have that, you know, just go get them kind of an attitude, just wanting to actually learn more. And the interesting thing is, as faculty, when we tell them certain things, they're thinking, well, what does he know? You know, he doesn't live in the real world. But here, if let's say you show up,
those
you know,
who can't do, right?
Right, those who can't do, exactly. Here comes the CEO of Firm X. They say the exact same thing, and they just look at it as if it's an act of God, just coming down from the sky, and this is it. Oh my God, this is genius. Yeah, that was like chapter one, first day of class. that's what we routinely go against. But I'm sure you guys probably used to think the same thing about faculty as well. It's a pretty standard thing.
Yeah, I actually specifically recall about 20 years ago, and I had a faculty member who was not a professor, and he was the guy who was in charge of the C-130 software project for Lockheed, and I thought he was the best professor I ever had, and then I found out he like didn't even have a PhD. But that was my experience. I guess to your point, you know, when you're 18 or 19, you're
now my favorite professor of all time actually has a degree in painting from Bowling Green, and I didn't even know that was a degree, and he was an IT professor
or a city. Bowling Green, is that where they make Corvettes?
I don't know.
I think it might be close by. Can you also talk about, there's been a lot of discussions around STEM, so which is science, technology, engineering, and math, which is a move of curriculum of a lot of schools. I know high schools are starting to look at more of STEM curriculums for students to try to build more engineering. Can you guys talk about what KSU is doing in regards to STEM and your perception of that?
Right. So I run a program over the summers. I've been doing this for a couple of years. It was funded by Google, I got to say, via the Tides Foundation. They always want to specify that. And the idea was to look at middle schoolers. I feel that, and a lot of folks do believe the same thing as well, that but when it comes to high schools, wanting a child to go toward a STEM field when they're a high school kid, it's just too late for them. Even though they're, 12 years old? I don't know what's the high school age these days. Middle schoolers, on the other hand, focusing exclusively on 7th, 8th graders, there's more of a chance. You show them the value of something like STEM. Though in my case, I'm working on a project right now where we're calling it STEAM, and that brings in the arts. When I see kids who just routinely doodle all the time, they're just drawing, and I'm like, wow, you guys have real skill. But what if you actually use and leverage that skill? Because I think the biggest mistake we make is by just thinking, oh, let's give them an iPad, and hopefully they will join a STEM career or a STEM field. We hear the president talk about it, President Obama talk about it all the time. Oh, we need more STEM folks. Okay, well, how does that work? So you need to leverage what they're already excited about, what they're really kind of associated with, and then connect, you know, IT to it, which is really what STEM is all about. So, yeah, our summer camp focuses on, it's a week-long summer camp for middle schoolers, focuses on just making sure they just have fun. But the problem is, as much fun as we can have, STEM careers are usually tough careers. I'm not sure how many people are lining up for an engineering degree. It's not an easy degree. I mean, I would have liked to have one, but I don't think so. So we try to bring in folks who can talk about, hey, look, this is what we do when we have a college degree. So maybe a middle schooler can then just say, okay, well, there's a value to graduating from high school. I don't know if you guys know the Georgia high school graduation rates. They're like my algebra grade, okay? It's not that good. And then for that matter, you have to graduate from college. And our four-year graduation rates, I don't even know we talk about them. I think we start talking at like five-year level. No one expects to graduate in four anymore.
Yeah, no. It's not. So in your perception, like that discussion or focus needs to get moved down to the middle school and that, you know, when the kids are 11, 12 years old, where they start thinking about or getting engaged, you know, more engaged in technology.
Correct. And not just that, the other tough – I mean, it's such a tough thing because, you know, you have a summer camp. All right, so you have them for a week. What happens after that week gets done? Let's say the first week of June when we hold the summer camp. And it's at the Mobile Application Development Center. So how do you keep them engaged throughout the year?
Yeah.
So, the project I'm working on right now with Computers for Youth, we're going to King Middle School. It's one of those, and we're focusing on at-risk middle schoolers, and it has its own sets of challenges.
And for you guys, like that, is that something that you're, I guess it takes 4 or 5 years for you to see any results coming out of that. So, I mean, yeah, it's probably a small, percentage of those, 15-20% it's going to impact. But in the long run, it's going to make huge changes. Is there any way for you guys to track that?
That's a great question. I mean, that's always been an issue as far as tracking and how far can we track them, especially when you start talking about middle school or seventh grader. I mean, how long can you track them before they go to, like, Nova Scotia or Germany or something, and then that's it. It's over. We do keep tabs on him and we're hoping for the best in that case, but you know, more so STEM is not for everyone. That's the thing. So in a class of right now of 24 kids I'm working with, maybe 5 may join a STEM career, but maybe the other 17 might graduate from college. And that is the more overarching goal as well, that there is a value to a college degree.
Yeah.
But, ideally, do we want them to go to STEM? Yeah. But in a perfect world, you don't expect 100% to join STEM. We don't expect 100% to go through college either.
Yeah, can you? You'd mentioned in there that you guys are teaching with mobile, with iPads, and using some of the mobile labs at KSU for teaching some of those courses or summer camps. What's your thoughts around engaging kids with mobile, and how do you get them to? It seems like this natural to them, but how do you get them to learn actually think about software and science in the context of that?
Exactly. So I mean, mobile technology. So you give them an iPad, it's great. They're all used to it. Very intuitive. Problem is, it's just as distracting as well. It's very easy for them to suddenly switch from what they should be working on to a game. So that's why the focus sometimes in our summer camp is more about the process, just understanding. Let's say if we're developing a game, a lot goes into developing a game. So, for example, you need to come up with a storyboard. Well, that doesn't require an iPad. So we have them work with good old-fashioned pencil. They look at a pencil, go, what is this thing? And so there's actually a whole lecture on different kinds of pencils. And where do pencils come from? You know, that's a very interesting question to ask. And they're like, what do we need?
How do you turn it on?
Yeah, exactly. Wait a minute. What's the switch off right there? How come it's not? There's no laser coming out of it. So we focus on storyboards and just kind of have them go through this logic thinking, right? I mean, and again, in a STEM environment, it's all about the thinking. It's a very structured thinking. And if they understand the fact that this bit is important, then, you know, it's valuable to any kind of a degree, not just any STEM degree.
Yeah. And can you talk a little bit about at the university level, what's your thoughts on technology in the classroom? So I know some professors are very anti having computers and laptops and tablets and phones, and some they say this is the way it is. I got to deal with it. What's your thoughts on that?
I mean, if for me personally, if the class can benefit from a mobile technology or any kind of technologies, then why not just use it? Because, in some ways, it looks like faculty have become entertainers. You got to crack some jokes. You have to keep them engaged, but you still have to go back on point. It feels like I'm on the Tonight Show, actually, when I go to class. There's a 10-minute stand-up and maybe 5 minutes of actual quality content. and then we call it quits. We're done. You know, I mean, it's a 50-minute class.
Nice.
So
this is for the short attention span generation. Yeah, is that what it is?
Well, it's
interesting. The rest of the class is posted on Twitter?
Well, yeah. And it's funny because I am developing a free course that deals with cybersecurity. And most of that, you know, there'll be a lot of conversation on Twitter. So yeah, some faculty may not even like the idea of a free course, right? People do stuff with Coursera, edX, Udacity.
What's your thoughts on the multi online student communities, and when the large, you know, we're going to have 1,000 people enrolled online and try to teach a course online to a large group. I know one of the complaints I've heard is that there's a really small success ratio for a lot of people, you know, even finishing the classes. What's your thoughts on those?
That's what the literature is saying. I guess at that point, so you're talking about those massive open online courses. if you show a pathway to, let's say, credit or a pathway to some kind of a professional learning credit of some sort. So let's say for an InfoSec, you have the CISSP, a Certificate of Information System Security. And you say, well, okay, if you take this MOOC, you will get X amount of professional learning credit hours. So maybe there's a value associated like that. Then maybe you will have a few more people finish. But look, if 10,000 people join in, and let's say 30% finish, that might still be better than how many people finish college right now.
Yeah.
So I think colleges will obviously get into this because they don't want to be left behind. But you have to make sure that when you design a course, you're designing a MOOC in a very different manner. You can't just record a stand-up lecture for, let's say, 45 minutes and just think, oh, that's it. I just translated my physical class to a MOOC, which is, again, a very different area altogether. So maybe you should focus more on shorter videos, like these 2-3 minute videos, because someone who's working on a MOOC, if they see, let's say you're interviewing someone at 10 o'clock, you don't have time for a 35 minute lecture. You may have time for 2 minutes before we go live. So
yeah,
you have to change the way you teach a class based on whatever environment you're going in.
So if you had to cut your stand-up routine from 15 minutes down to 3 or 4.
No, that's still 15. Still 15. I think that one actually has value. So not quite Saturday Night nice. Live, but yeah, you need to obviously just engage the student in some way, you know, some shape or form.
Awesome. And then you mentioned SPSU, so Southern Polytechnic State University, and KSU had a merger early this year, I guess was the time frame of it?
I believe they call it consolidation. Merger seems to imply that it's a takeover and then you bought them out or something.
Yeah, I just figured there was somebody up there with a monopoly hat and a little a monocle who was making these decisions. But the consolidation, can you talk a little bit about, is that changed any of the way that you guys, or have you guys able to leverage or take advantage of the fact that you have a bigger student base and more classes, or is that changing any of the curriculum?
Well, we're hoping it will, because the merger, I believe, is official starting January 1. The board votes on it later on this year. I'm pretty sure it's going to go through. For the first time, KSU will have access to engineering students. KSU never had an engineering degree, for that matter. Now we'll have a college of engineering. So all of a sudden, you actually have a student base that is well-versed in, let's say, computer engineering. There's actually a software engineering program as well. So, yeah, we're hoping, at least from the mobile application development MAD center, right? From a MAD center point of view, we suddenly have access to a certain type of a student. The real nerd, so to speak. Because engineers, I still think, can do magic. That's the thing with engineers. Software engineers, not so much. But computer engineers, absolutely.
Nice. Awesome. Well, so you said if people want to find more information about you, where they look online?
I'll speak about my department, right? So the Information Systems Department, you can go to colescollege.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at The Real Doctor Zuffer.
Can you spell it out so it says
Coles?
C-O-L-E-S.
C-O-L-E-S. C-O-L-L-E-G-E. I'm hoping we can spell college.
Coles is hard, though, because people might confuse with the department store.
And then they just get distracted and start shopping. Right, yeah. There we go. The EPA will be on us then.
Well, awesome. Thank you very much for being on this morning, and I'll back to you with a couple questions in a minute here. So also on today, we have Greg Birch from Ingenico, and you're going to help me out with your title. It's also long, and I've proven not good at reading long titles. So I got the VP of Mobility piece, and there was a couple other components of your title that I think you wear like 5 or 6 hats, I'm guessing.
Yeah, wear a few. Yeah, VP of Mobility, Business Development, and ISV Relationships. I'm told it's the longest title in the history of our company.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yes. Did you get a word for that, or was it a...
I did. Outside of my office, there's a little
plaque on the wall, but it was too long to fit on the wall, so they actually had to make it into 2 plaques. Nice. So Ingenico, I'm familiar with Ingenico because I shop a lot, and I see all of your product whenever I check out. But can you give an audience a little bit of a feel for the types of product lines you guys have and the areas where you guys are working, both in retail and also in the mobility space?
Sure. So Ingenico is the world's largest provider of mobile and security solutions. And our product lines span what you see when you shop in a lot of retailers around the Atlanta area. In lane, you'll see our products at the end of the lane. So you go into Home Depot, Walmart. We manufacture the product that you swipe your card on. And we also help manage actually transaction routing on the back end when it comes to mobility. We'll take the technology that you see in lane and put it in small handheld devices and then handle the routing of those transactions, especially as you go down into the smaller merchants.
And so when you say routing of transactions, so that I swipe my card, they register, rings some pieces up, Mm-hmm. The card gets swiped, and Ingenico takes whatever was in the register. It says, you know, $142.36. You guys will go do the card processing for me, or does that go to the, you know, you guys handle some sort of secure transport to the company's processing centers? What's that look like?
For the smaller merchants, we'll handle the routing to the processor. For the large enterprise merchants, we typically will encrypt the data and then we'll hand it back to the enterprise system. A lot of times the system nowadays, especially in mobility, it's extending itself onto commercial products,
yep,
like an Apple, Android, or Windows tablet. The significance of our product is it encrypts this sensitive cardholder data before those tablets ever see the information.
Does it encrypt it right when it comes off the card? So it's on the encryption at the head, I think is the term for that?
Yeah, ours is a little more sophisticated because our customers demand that we encrypt it regardless of the input mechanism. So it encrypts the card data, whether it's swiped or if it's manually entered on the keyboard or if it's accepted through an NFC read or through the chip. So we can encrypt it any of those areas.
And can you touch a little bit on NFC and what that actually means? So I the experience that everybody's seen in the Apple videos is you just touch your phone and then it prompts you and you put your finger on it and it pays. What's actually happening there? What's that under the hood process look like?
So in the case of Apple in particular, it's really sophisticated. On a broader scale, NFC is near field communications. So depending on the ISO standard you're using, there's a couple that define how that interaction takes place. The ISO 14443 standard, for example, you tap a phone or a card onto our device, and it looks just like a credit card transaction, credit card data coming through. There's another standard called ISO 18092, which is primarily being used for two-way communication so that your phone could come into the area of an NFC reader, and after you use your fingerprint, there can be an exchange back and forth, not just your card data coming over, but also getting loyalty information, updating points, applying coupons to a grand total, a more dynamic experience.
So when it actually does that transaction, is it passing a token or is it passing my encrypted credit card information?
Good question. So it depends on the technology being used. You mentioned your Apple phone, for example. In that case, it's passing a token. So your card data is actually not going through the system.
And what about Google Wallet? What does it do? What's its mechanism look like?
Yeah, so they encrypt typically on our device, they'll encrypt. And it really depends on the infrastructure of where that data is going. Once you encrypt it, depending on the standard you use, the system may need to be able to accommodate that encryption.
Cool. And so SquarePay has been, I think they're the leader in, when you go to fairs and places, small merchants in the last few years, I've definitely seen them move into the, people have an iPad or a tablet and are able to take payment using one of those SquarePays. Can you talk about how you guys compare to them and, what the similarities and differences are?
Sure. So I think what's interesting about Square is they made getting set up to take payment really easy. So kudos to them for doing that. There's been a lot of debate in the marketplace in our space about how secure it is. Everything we've researched on Square is that they encrypt actually inside the phone. So there's a small area between where the card is read and when it gets to the phone where it's in the clear. We acquired a company called Roam Data, which has now become our mobile solutions group within Ingenico. And the difference with that technology is we encrypt at the read head itself so that the phone never has access to any data in the clear. The other difference between what we do and what Square does is we're really focused on service. Some of the reports, even by some of the local news agencies, have said that Square is very easy to get a hold of. When you need help, you primarily go through online forums. With us, we really pride ourselves in having a phone call and a person you can talk to if you have any issues.
Awesome. So when payment doesn't work, I can call you directly and
exactly.
Complain about it. Nice.
Yep.
All right. So hit Greg up on Twitter. And do you see the merchants, I know there's a couple players in the marketplace. So is there something that is going to change or shift for merchants in the next few years? Is it going to be more of, there's going to be I hate to say this, but there's been a couple of security breaches in the last 2 years, but are people going to try to go through a modernization, leverage technology like yours? What's going to happen in the next 3 years?
Yeah, there's a few advances that are happening. One is ensuring that encryption is happening in secure devices like we make so that systems never see the sensitive cardholder data. So if a hacker gets access to a large database of cards, they're just getting access to encrypted data that they can't decrypt. I'd say that's the major. The other two would be, of course, EMV is coming. There is a liability shift date.
So what does EMV stand for? So that is the European model of something, or is it like the DMV only slower?
Yeah. Europay, MasterCard, Visa. And that's a second one that's coming. And that's basically chip card technology used on the existing kind of credit card you have. You'll get a new card in the mail.
So when people say chip and PIN, that's what they're talking about, right?
Exactly.
I guess there's no PIN in the U.S., though. When they go to Europe, they always want to enter PINs. That's the European standard is there's a microchip on the cards that contains some sort of token, or what does it actually have on it?
The card is actually, the little chip is a microprocessor, and it has an operating system, it has applications, and every time you use the card, it's reprogrammed. So the significance of it is you can't duplicate the card with most technology available today. Theoretically, there's some college theories that have been done and some research about how you could.
Probably the engineering department, I'm guessing.
I think so.
The engineering guys will wear a big backpack and they'll walk into a store and have something up their sleeve and they'll show they can do it. But the standard is, the significance of it is a standard agreed upon by all the card brands. Whereas if you look at the third major evolution happening with mobile wallets, that is competitive. And so you're seeing a lot of jockeying for position. You're seeing a lot of different types of technology come out at the same time. And it really remains to be seen which one, maybe more than one, maybe three or four, get a good foothold in the marketplace.
But at the end of the day, whatever the solution is going to have more security because it's creating a non-reproducible chain of numbers that's built into the device itself. And then your PIN pads and the services that you guys sell, what's the support? Are they support like 4 or 5 standards? How do you guys approach that when you build a solution? If I go buy something from Ingenico, what does it support?
Good question. So when we build products, we approach it from the standpoint of building a platform, and we want to support everything. We put a lot of money into that, and one of the ways we're able to do it is we make a single platform that's used all over the world. So we're in 125 major companies, and literally the same hardware, maybe the keyboard's a little different or the power, it's the same operating system all over the world. So we focus on being able to accept all the different payment types. Even our small mobile handheld products, they have NFC readers in them. They have chip card readers. They have an encrypting PIN, encrypting read head. Everything to take all the different forms of payment we see evolving.
Cool. And so if I'm a small merchant, how do I go and get Ingenico PIN pads? Is it something where I go through Avar, I come directly to you guys, similar to Square? What's that process look like? How are you making that process easy for folks?
For a small merchant, it's most likely happening through the bank. Another way we're different from Square is we don't typically go out to Ingenico.com and sell our products. We're primarily the manufacturer. And we'll use distribution mechanisms such as banks to distribute our products. So if you go to the bank, your local bank, and you open a business account, likely our solution is an option for you to use in your store.
Nice. And so I just get it, and I purchase a PIN pad, and then they just take a percentage like they normally do from credit card transactions.
Exactly.
Awesome. And the we talked a little bit about the Apple Pay versus Google Wallet. What's your perception on how that's going to play out in the next 4 or 5 years? I feel that there's been a big push by Google for, I would say, probably upwards of 3 years now, and I've never seen anybody actually support that. But Apple, like I said earlier, it feels like magic. I just walk up to an Ingenico PIN pad now, and would you like to pay with your phone? I'm like, I guess. So where do you see that going, from a market standpoint in the next next year or two?
I think the answer to that is literally a multi-million-dollar question, if you know the answer conclusively.
So where should I place my bets? What can you not say?
Well, honestly, I think that Apple is really genius with how they've come out with their solution, leveraging the existing infrastructure and partnering with a lot of the major players in that infrastructure. So I think what we're seeing so far, just acceptance from the marketplace, is there's so much press following what's happening with them. A lot of merchants are trying to figure out how they can accept the technology and what do they need. Ultimately, I believe it's going to depend on the consumer. Is it easy enough to use, and are consumers using it? Once we start seeing those kind of numbers, it'll give you a real sense of where that's going to take off. Even if it does, that is you know, one platform. So what will merchants do and what will consumers do that have Android phones or that have Windows phones? What will be their wallet? So that's where I think Google, with, you know, a arguably infinite amount of resources, could potentially continue. We expect they'll continue to evolve and they'll continue to adapt. And if they see Apple Pay being successful, you can bet that they'll have an answer to that.
Nice. And the another question I had is that the thing that's really nice on the iPhone 6 Plus, the giant fab note, that the iPad I hold to my face when I make phone calls now, the thumb scanner on it, it seems very, very reliable for most of the time. And you know, when I pay, it prompts me, I put my thumb on it, and it just it pays automatically. So in Ingenico itself, you guys make fingerprint scanners, and that's one of the lines of products you guys sell, I believe, for different applications. Where do you see like fingerprint scanning technology going in the mobile space in the next few years?
Great question. So today we use that primarily in emerging markets. So in places like Africa and India, where a lot of people may not have a signature that they use, some people will use an X, will use fingerprint, and we'll use it for beyond payment. It'll be used for voting and other identification applications on our products. With the U.S., the early demand we see so far is access to security systems and in restaurants, potentially use server identification by swiping your thumb instead of swiping a server card.
Yep.
I think in the past there's been this concept of individual rights that have kept us from pushing too hard with fingerprint or any kind of biometric technology. But it does appear, to your point, that the Apple using their fingerprint is really starting to make that acceptable now. So it's very exciting.
When will I see this in the election voting booths? Because last week was terrible for me.
Yeah.
I like the old ladies that do it, but they're not the fastest.
Yeah.
Is that, do you think, ever see that happening where the U.S. will start somewhere adopting either mobile technology for voting or fingerprints or something better than having to show like four pieces of identification to somebody who's got to check her glasses a couple times?
Yeah, probably between 4 and 50 years, somewhere in there.
Well, unless you see a severed thumb. Hey,
you guys heard it here first, 4 to 50 years.
Yep, bet your money on that.
Nice. All right, the $1 million answer right there. And it won't be worth very much in 50 years, will it? Nice. And then I think another question just around security itself, and this is probably a question for both of you guys in regards to the security of mobile payments. I feel that with credit cards themselves, it's been proven, there's probably a dozen retailers in the last 2 years that have had large data breaches. How do consumers feel secure when you go through this process? You have to sign stuff, you put in PIN number, and then your data still gets breached on the back end. What are companies doing to help create more security around that? And maybe Greg, you can speak to this first.
Sure, that's a great question. So I think one of the advantages to having payment happen from a mobile device instead of a card is the instant authentication that can happen, especially for people in the U.S. who are used to just swiping a card. There's really no way to tell conclusively that you're the person swiping that card. There's a couple of, hey, can I see your ID, or enter the last four digits, but still we see a lot of fraud happening. So what's exciting about the use of the phone is you're typically going to authenticate on the phone that you are who's making the payment.
Yep. So more like token, more of a token-based authentication than...
Yeah, and then from then on, it just depends on what technology is being used when it leaves the phone to make sure that data stays secure. So as you see, the breaches you mentioned that continue to come out, that focus is definitely shifting towards a back-end encryption and making sure that's in place. So as more solution providers provide that, you'll start to see it go away. So we are at a kind of a critical time as these technologies evolve, because it remains to be seen if consumers feel safe with their data. And we predict there's going to be some segment of the consumers that don't want to put anything in an electronic device that could be breached.
I mean, they got it under their mattress anyways.
Exactly. It's
probably Humani, what's your thoughts on in regards to that kind of same concept of data that's going into the clouds and how, EC2 seems like the... When there's EC2 outage, I feel like half the internet goes down now. What's your thoughts on data that's not, it's not anywhere inside of a company, but it's in cloud technology? What's the conventional thinking amongst the security academia?
Well, I mean, That's a good question. We can ask Jennifer Lawrence. We can ask Kate Upton. I mean, there's only two people who are laughing.
I was like, you can get the phone out. Finally, somebody's connected.
Exactly. I think, let me just backtrack. You know, for the longest time, I think Craig here answered everything as far as the back end goes. But we look at phones from a consumer point of view. And I'm not sure how many consumers are even aware of what a token is. Maybe they think token is something you get at, like, I don't know, like Dave and Buster's or, yeah, exactly. Yeah. You just play a game. So I think customers need to be aware of what the cloud actually is. You know, they literally think that a cloud is a cloud. So, you know, apparently in the summers, there are no clouds. So, I mean, even cloud-based storage is, you know, we've got, it's somewhere, right? Where does it reside? What kind of policies apply at that point? If you're in the middle of nowhere and you're not in the United States, well, the same laws don't apply, right? So if you're in Europe, you've got a different set of privacy requirements. Mm-hmm. You're in the U.S., you've got a very different batch as well. And if you're in Hawaii or something, then you're just relaxing on the beach. So I do think customers just need to be educated about it. I think so. So we always go back to that good old-fashioned SATA, right? Security, education, training, and awareness.
Yep.
So for we always look at it, at least right now, as far as mobility goes, we look at it from that consumer angle, because without a consumer, there is no Apple Pay, right? Apple Pay, the greatest thing going for it is tokenization. That's number one thing. But if customers, right now it's only on two different phones, but if customers don't adopt it, it's over. Google Wallet has been around for a long time. But for somewhere down the line, mobile payments has been very successful in Japan for decades. Well, not decades, but at least a decade. You look at NTT Docomo, South Korea, another one.
Yeah.
What is it that makes them successful? So cloud, I think, is just one microcosm of this entire environment around us. So we could potentially look at the South Koreas. We can look at the Japans and see, okay, what is it you do? Even some of the African countries, for that matter, have had mobile payment systems for years. But most of them looked at it from that mobile banking point of view, because you didn't just have a branch to go to. You're like in Kenya, okay, you got to run to a place or something.
Yeah, phone. Not a lot of ATMs there.
No, not too many ATMs.
The currency devalue as well, sitting in the ATMs, in most places, yeah.
And quite frankly, it's right now, it looks like the users are only educated through the media. Okay, something bad happens. So there's a Target breach. Okay, I don't know. How many of you shop at Target?
I appear to shop at Target based on my credit card results.
I am still waiting for the letter that says, hey, you were breached or something. I still haven't received anything from their president.
I got my third.
Your third letter?
Yeah.
I shopped at all of them. I've got a red card. It just doesn't make a difference. But right now, I mean, for example, when I said Kate Upton, again, most people realize, oh, yeah, iCloud. Someone got access.
So that scenario wasn't a data breach, right? Can you kind of explain what happened there? So that's kind of the education point, where people have their password as small kitty or password.
Right,
one.
Right. I mean, look, the number one thing we always go for is like, okay, don't use a password that's guessable. Don't use your name, your date of birth, something you put up saying it's my password. I read somewhere literally that 60% of the people in an office, because do you guys have like strong password requirements at your firms? Like, you know, 77 different characters, can't use uppercase, lowercase, or can't use them together. 60-some% of the people actually do put their passwords on a Post-it next to their terminal. Well, I don't blame them, because I'd be doing something like that. Then they went to the passphrases, right? Like, okay, passphrases are, you know, tough. Well, what if you just say, traffic on I-75 sucks in the mornings? You know, some people can actually guess that, I think. So yeah, you know, as far as the iCloud, just in case some of us were involved.
Is that your password?
Yeah. No, I can't. I think I use the same password. I just change the last character every time.
Do you use tools like LastPass or?
Yeah, LastPass? I. You know, the funny thing is, I do. Then I just get lazy after a while. So I think that's our biggest issue as well. You know, folks just they see something, they're a little careful for a month, and we're done.
I guess the key is making it easy. I think that maybe where Apple's doing a good job making it easy. Just put my finger on it.
Imagine if I could do the exact same thing with all of them.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I go into Yahoo. Or does anyone still use Yahoo? I don't know. Or am I the only one? So
fantasy football is good. Yeah. It is. I mean, they're still better than Well, let's move on. So wearables, you talked a little bit about, you know, that device types. Do you think that wearables are going to have, be a security token that people start to use in the future? So having, you know, instead of having a phone that can be stolen, something that's more attached to my wrist. You know,
which can also be stolen.
It can be stolen, but yeah, it's a slightly harder. I mean, it's a, you know, security in layers, right? But what's your thoughts on wearables and security around wearables and using those for payment?
Sure. I mean, look, you look at ubiquitous technologies, right? I mean, the concept of wearables has been around for a while, but as soon as Apple does something, it apparently becomes like this brand new thing. It's been around for a very long time. So ever use a blood pressure cuff or a heart, you know, those things that wirelessly send signals, you're wearing that technically. You can break into that one too, by the way. But as far as the watch goes, if that's what you're getting at, I'm still not sure. I mean, I've got this old school watch, which I like to wear every once in a while. And I like that watch. I'm not sure if the wearable part is for me, but it may be for a particular segment of a population that's, you know, in a middle school or high school where it's kind of cool to wear a watch. But I do think it opens itself to its own set of security questions as well, because that's just that one extra thing that a person can steal. I don't know, if you go to New York, you have some guy selling fake Rolexes, so maybe you'll see fake iWatches or something too.
It would not surprise me.
Go to Central Park, I have whips out a little jacket, and bam, you got Apple iWatches or something.
I'll keep my eyes out for that when I'm up there.
But you know, with the phablets, I guess it makes sense to have a watch, because if you can do most of the things with that watch, you don't have to whip out this phablet and have this issue with, oh my God, I'm like Frodo.
Yeah.
Can't do anything.
Nice. Greg, what's your thoughts on wearables and actually using those for payment?
I love the idea personally. I think anything that is driving towards a lot of our customers see a goal to have frictionless payment. So being able to wear devices on yourself that as you're walking around the store, potentially you're sharing information about yourself, but you're also getting information relevant to you. So you don't need to get a special on women's shoes if what you're looking for is a pair of men's loafers. The specials are targeted to you. I think it's exciting myself.
Yeah, I think my rule of thumb is that if it does something different than what a salesperson would do when they walked up to me, it probably is going to verge on being very creepy. Yeah, a sales guy can walk up to you and be like, Greg, it looks like you probably don't want women's shoes, but you're probably interested in loafers. But yeah, I think that when it starts getting into like the edge of creepiness, that's where I worry about it. And then one of the other things, and we talked about the payments for places like Africa and other countries. What's your thoughts on some of the newer currencies? Greg, maybe speak to, I know Bitcoin's been popular and there's, you know, payment via phone. What do you guys see in that space? And have you guys tried to foray into online currencies at all?
Yeah, so it's a good question. There's a lot of industry debate about BitPay having an online currency that's not necessarily regulated by anyone.
It's Bitcoins. BitPay is the merchant.
BitPay
service.
Is a company. Exactly. Thanks. Yeah. That shows you how it experienced.
Yeah, Tony and those guys are super sharp. But yeah.
Yeah, so Bitcoin being independent of any specific company regulation potentially certainly gets a lot of debate. Our opinion, when you look at, or my personal opinion, when you look at the history of payments, there's never really been a payment method completely eliminated. I still write 2 checks a week. People still barter. People pay a lot with credit cards. And so when we see something that's starting to get traction, we definitely want to not shy away from it, but embrace it. So we're definitely open to watching Bitcoin, seeing how it's evolving. We have a partnership with BitPay where we're exploring how our products can work with their technology. We definitely want to make sure we are not there was probably a people at Blockbuster sitting around a boardroom saying nobody will ever download movies. It's ludicrous, and we definitely want to be more forward thinking than that.
Yeah, no, it definitely makes sense. And I guess from a security standpoint, what do you guys think about alternate currencies?
Bitcoin. Wow. I mean, so first off, not sure exactly who values Bitcoin, right? There's no actual central.
It's a market. It's a completely free market.
It could be like 30 cents or like a gazillion.
Yeah.
Let's say the drive, your bit, is it BitWallet? What is it, that thing that stores the Bitcoin?
There's a couple different ones. Yeah. So you get there's Bitcoin wallets.
Right. So let's say your hard drive crashes. goodbye Bitcoins. I mean, that effectively is gone as well, right?
It's the same thing. Yeah, it's the same as if you put your money in your mattress and your mattress lights on fire.
Well, then that's just, you're just dumb then. I mean.
So it's the same. I mean, have a backup, put it in a safety deposit box, and you're good to go, right?
I guess, if you say so. But I still think there's, Bitcoins is just so, and how many people use Bitcoin, by the way? I mean, how many merchants actually? We got two, maybe three.
Well, I think there's a number are starting to pick it up. I know that the Bitcoin Bull in December, I think that all the merchants in St. Pete are going to be supporting it, which is it's pretty interesting. It seems like a very big initiative. I know BitPay is working on down there, but to your point, I think that Greg made his comment earlier, when you don't have people adopting it on the consumer side, that's where it gets hard. So I don't think there's as many consumers. Because it's not as common for small items. I think their biggest benefit is when you're trying to buy a computer online. It's guaranteed the other person on the other end is actually giving you the money.
Right,
when they say
right.
They are, so you're not shipping something to.
There's nothing physical about it. I mean, even Apple Pay to me is more physical than Bitcoin. Like, at least it's in my hand. There it is, right here. It's a token thing.
Yeah.
And it's going to First Data or something, but. Bitcoin, I can't hold it. I don't know what it is. And is there a guarantee that this transaction is even going to occur? Can you reverse a transaction in a Bitcoin environment?
No, you can't.
You can't.
Well, see, there we blockchain, go. So, it's good.
But if you don't like whatever it is you got from that salesman or something, what happens then?
You better make sure you like it.
Yeah, you better. Yeah, yeah. You better make sure you. Yeah.
People just need to think about what they're buying before they start buying it.
So there's a. I mean, these are non-security related questions. And because security, honestly, is. It can't be something that stops you from a business process. It should not. It shouldn't be something that just tethers you to a cable. It should work around it. You just really have to get a more of a sense about it. But it shouldn't be a showstopper.
Yep. All right. Last question before we get wrapped up here. Android versus iOS. You want to get me started? What's your thoughts? I know. See is that a Google 7-inch phone in your hand?
What's seriously? That is.
Nice.
The 6 Plus right here. I mean.
I thought that was the Samsung from 3 years ago.
No.
But what's your thoughts on the platforms? And, as somebody who has to teach and work with students on them, what are your general thoughts on where it's going to go?
Well, I mean, it's interesting when you look at just how they go about their business. You've got Apple that has a stronghold on, the hardware and the software. And, of course, with iOS 8 and iPhone 6, it's really a lot better, I think, than the past. Google on the other side. Android on the other side, of course, it's on multiple platforms. These are very different business processes. And you got Microsoft on the other hand. Show of hands, how many of you here have a Microsoft phone?
On me right now?
Yeah, right now. I mean, who uses a Microsoft phone?
I don't have one. I have one on my desk.
Minus one people actually use that one. But
3.4% of the market. They're big in the enterprise
space.
But
what they're doing is also pretty neat, though. Yeah. I mean, think about it, right? They're saying, okay, well, we're going to have just this one OS across the board. Not what Apple does, but maybe they're moving with it with their new OS X that integrates a little better with iOS. I tried making a call, by the way, through my Mac. Didn't really work out all that well. It's just started making these humming sounds as if I'm next to a microphone. So is your question who's number one? What's going to happen?
Where do you see it going in the next 2 years? Do you think there'll be more Android adoption? Is it going to get bigger in the market, or is it going to stay where it is?
That's a good question. That's a tricky question. Either way, I'm like a weatherman at that point.
You see the kids coming up from college. I mean, that's a good leading indicator, isn't
it? I think a lot. Obviously, Apple did something very good for the market when they came out with this idea of not requiring a keyboard on a phone. Now, I think Samsung then just started doing things a little better. I don't know if you – have you guys seen the one with the curved edges right now?
Yeah, it's kind of nice. It feels sexy.
Yeah, and it's you think, well, that is very Apple-esque. But Apple was the one that started it. So I'm hoping that Apple at some point kind of wakes up and does something – because that's what you expect Apple to do something extravagant. Even the idea of a watch. I mean, everyone knew that a watch was coming out. I mean, it was leaked forever. Maybe they'll do something with. I think Android will not grow in terms of other markets, but I think Apple might start going into more of a cable TV market. For all we know,
so Apple will buy Tesla and Comcast. I think TV with my car self drives.
So I read about that somewhere. I think so. I think that you I'd be surprised if Apple does, because they have cash.
I need to put a buy order in.
Right.
All right, Greg, what's your thoughts? I know you guys probably pay a lot of attention to just based on the payment formats. What's your thoughts on Android versus iOS and even Windows 8.1 and 10?
from an Ingenico standpoint, so our strategy is to work with all of that. All mobile devices are compatible with Windows, Android, iOS across the board. if you look at the statistics, latest statistics we've seen are that iOS products are tending to be used very heavily, high percentage of people above certain income brackets. And the lower income brackets tend to be very high percentage of users are Android. So if that trend continues, then you'll presumably see a very high percentage of Android units continuing to grow in the marketplace.
So Android is the people's phone.
Well, Apple has the 5C, though they went away with that.
That's true. So if they go back into that or try another formula with that. But you're right, it wasn't really... I think
it did well overseas, but I'll be interested to see how it plays out. It's a good mm-hmm. way to think about the Android and how that's going to change the market. Sort of wrap it up here. Thank you guys very much for joining the show today. And Ingenico, can you spell the website for folks in case?
Yeah, Ingenico, INGENICO.US.
Awesome. And then Cole's Business School?
Coleskollege.com. Coleskollege.com.
Awesome. Thank you guys very much for being on today. And that we'll talk to you guys soon.
You got it. Thanks.
Thank you.